The following may contain offensive language, adult humor, and or content that some viewers may find offensive. The views and opinions expressed by any one speaker does not explicitly or necessarily reflect or represent those of Mark Rattledge or W2M Network. Please listen with caution, or don't listen at all.
Welcome to On Trial, starring Mark Rattledge, also starring Sean Comer. Hope you're ready, Hollywood, because you're on trial.
All rise. The Honorable Harry T. Stone providing. This is a Rattledge and Broadcasting premiere podcast on trial. And tonight I am your prosecuting attorney, Mr. Mark Rattledge, on Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified that is Mr. Mark Rattledge. And on the docket for tonight is Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby from 2013. Which is an American historical romantic drama based on the 1925 novel of the same name by Scott Fitzgerald. No, wait, that's a Ted joke. F. Scott Fitzgerald. The film was co-written and directed by Baz Luhrmann and stars an ensemble cast consisting of Leonardo DiCaprio, Tobey Maguire, Carey Mulligan in a role that doesn't make you want to punch her in the face, Joel Edgerton, Isla Fisher, Jason Clarke, Amitabh Bachchan, and Elizabeth Debicki in a role that doesn't want to make you punch her in the face. Filming took place from September to December 2011 in Australia with a $105 million net budget, and it follows the life and times of millionaire Jay Gatsby and his neighbor Nick Carraway, otherwise known as Spider-Man, who recounts his interactions with Gatsby amid the riotous parties of the Jazz Age on my hometown of Strong Island, yo, in New York. All right, and of course, defending this magnum opus is the one and only Sean Comer. You're not. Hello. How do you do, Sean?
Oh, Mark, I will be your Marky Post any day, baby.
Oh, boy.
Rat-a-tat-tat, that's the sound of my Gatsby.
All right. So this is a kind of a part two of our look at Baz Luhrmann. We did the Red Curtain trilogy late last year as a long road to ruin. And the Red Curtain trilogy was made up of Moulin Rouge, Strictly Ballroom, and Romeo and Juliet. And we were talking about how much we really appreciate Baz Luhrmann. He doesn't always make like the strictest, strongest, or proud pleasing movies, but he's one of those directors that we celebrate on the Rattledge Broadcasting Network for having a deft touch when it comes to visuals and really making use of the silver screen. I love this guy to death, and I'll watch anything that he puts out. And as I said back then, I'll always love the music video that he did. That was basically, he put the graduation speech to music. Everyone's free to wear sunscreen or whatever the hell it was. I had to play
that
for my kids.
Wear sunscreen.
Yeah. Yeah, and don't forget to wear sunscreen. I played that for my kids, and my Jonas had so many questions. But I love Baz Luhrmann. And so when we were talking about the Red Curtain trilogy, we haven't been doing a lot of on trials as of late, you know, preferring the triple feature format of just kind of like, hey, 20 to 30 minutes, let's just talk about the movie and move on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. We don't need to draw this out. But Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby is something that I have wanted to watch and talk about. I showed it to my kids, and to my son's eternal credit, he was like, this is the most invested I've been in a movie in months. I was like, wow, that came from an almost 10-year-old. I wanted to give this the full on trial treatment. And I'm prosecuting tonight, which means I'm going to nitpick the shit out of this. Sean's going to rightfully tell you how wonderful it is, and we'll go from there. So that being said, Sean, tell me about those. Unzip your pants and show me those notes, baby. That's where you keep your notes, isn't it? It's where you keep your notes, isn't it?
In your pants? No. I'm just mystified because pants. We were supposed to wear pants. What now did I miss?
The Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network. We are as pantsless as we are funny. Interpret that any way you wish.
So, growing up, I did not come from a background that tended to exude a whole lot of investment in fine art. Let's just say definitely not classic American literature. That's not necessarily a knock. It's just that my family's backgrounds and tastes were what they were. Dad in particular, anything that really leaned into any kind of symbolism or metaphor or the abstract, he just rejected it out of hand. He liked his movies, his TV, and his books pretty much about as literal and straightforward and in many instances as fucking bland as they could possibly get. To give you some idea, this is the guy that always said of All in the Family that, oh, I always liked Archie Bunker, but, you know, then I found out that Carol Connor was such a lib. Completely missing the point that Archie Bunker existed to take the piss out of people like my dad. But anyway, point being. So I didn't exactly grow up with a real keen mind for the fascination of rhetorical devices in literature. And so when I finally got around to reading The Great Gatsby in my AP English class in high school, it was one of the most droll, torturous experiences of the year for me.
Right.
Because I didn't have that kind of appreciation for what Foxcotch Fitzgerald was actually trying to get across about his time. So it just kind of went on and on. Here is this pretentious, white as bleached mayo, great American novel. Which, by the way, there's a concept I fucking hate. With nary a likable character to be found. And mercifully, at least it was short. I can say that much about it. And then I just kind of forgot about it. And then years later, you know, 2013, the movie's about to come out. It's getting a ton of buzz. And it's kind of become a bit of a hipster touchstone, for lack of a more graceful term, because you know how people are. Every so often, something will come along that will touch on some kind of taste or medium or genre or whatever that's just. If it's not niche, it's so old as to just kind of be naturally obscure. The best comparison I can make, the fucking khaki ads and the swing revival. About like that because all of a sudden here's this really droll Caucasian novel that I couldn't get through quickly enough in high school. And all of a sudden everybody's celebrating. Here people are having Gatsby-themed house parties. Because they're so taken with this movie. And of course, it's a combination of an adaptation of a novel that I didn't like, headed by an actor that I've always regarded as being quite possibly the most overrated of his generation.
Yeah, we've had that fight already.
We'll get to that. I got some words I got to eat later.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm saying, miss me with this trendy retro bullshit. And then I made that affirmation Facebook post before I watched the movie for the podcast. And my good friend Cole pipes up in my DMs and is kind of shocked that I legitimately hated The Great Gatsby. And he said something to me that actually kind of turned my thought process on end a little bit. And it kind of started to drive home just how much I had maybe missed that first time around. And that was, he said, well, it's kind of supposed to be pretentious because really, Foxcotch, he didn't actually call him Foxcotch, but he's Foxcotch Fitzgerald forever. You can thank Mark for that.
What I'm here for.
Pointed out to me, well, it's kind of supposed to, because it's supposed, that's supposed to get across and deepen the immersion in this tragically optimistic fantasy world that Gatsby has built, where he's living in a fantasy. He's living in kind of a combination of a misremembered past and an unfortunately idyllic vision of the future. And it's supposed to kind of drag you into that. And I kind of went, huh. Okay. Maybe this is worth the benefit of a doubt after all. And so not only did I watch the movie, not only did I go back and listen to the audiobook, which now makes twice in a lifetime that I've given this novel a chance. But I also went to YouTube, and because I like to sometimes check out a couple of content creators to see if maybe they can inspire a thought process or something I can talk about on the show, I checked out both Dominic Noble's excellent episode of Lost in Adaptation that was dedicated to comparing and contrasting Gatsby 2013 and the original novel. But I also checked out, and I'll get to this a little bit later on, this terrific little analysis by the Sin Squad, where they looked at a queer reading of the story that's developed. And it's really kind of a miraculous little enhancement to the original work that there's no way Foxcotch could have possibly anticipated at the time, especially given his really blatant prejudices. We'll just kind of put it that way. Foxcotch is kind of a dick. But you know, he's only human. He's writing what he knew, and what he knew was being an affluent, sheltered white man in the 20s.
So yes, Wes Anderson from the 1920s.
You're not wrong. You are so not wrong. So that's kind of about it. And I agreed to defend it because by the time Mark asked me, I was already halfway through the movie and probably more immersed than I've been in any of Baz's movies that I've watched so far. I really didn't see that coming. So this was another plum choice. Good call, Mr. Radulich.
All right, so we're going to just briefly touch on the plot. Yes. I read the book in high school too. I had much the same reaction to it. This is one of those books where, and I'm only going to say this, and I'm going to go right into the plot. I am all for making high school students read great literature. This is the year of our Lord 2024, so I won't just say great American or great Caucasian, just whatever the great books are, whoever wrote them, and wherever, whatever time period and whatever continent, whatever the best books are, I think high school students should be exposed to them. Especially these days, some of these might be too much book for people. The Great Gatsby was a little too much book for even kids back when I grew up, which was in the early 90s. I was in high school from 90 to 94. And, it was a struggle. On the other hand, it gets cited in The Wire season 2. It's one of my favorite scenes of that season, where they're doing the book club in prison and D'Angelo's talking about how Gatsby is fronting with all them books and he ain't read none of them. It's good stuff. I appreciate the impact F. Scott Fitzgerald and The Great Gatsby have had on American culture, and I don't think it's something to sneer at or forget. So it's definitely worth an examination. With that being said, so we have Tobey Maguire's character, who is Nick, who my son's, this is actually going to go to some of my prosecution, but my son's observation of Tobey Maguire's Nick is he's not really in the movie. He's just sort of standing around with this look of why am I here on his face? Like that's his whole, like this is about Daisy, Tom and Jay, and Nick's just kind of like, like a voyeur. He's just kind of hanging about. And Tobey Maguire has the same look on his face through the entire movie. Why am I here? Where are my pants? I thought it was pretty funny. Anyway, so Nick is getting psychiatric treatment, and like a good psychiatrist, they say, well, if you don't want to talk about it, you should at least write about it. And so he does. And so he recounts the events of previous times where he came to New York to find fame and fortune. He's selling bonds. He runs across an old cousin of his who is Daisy, who is married to Tom. And he gets an invitation to his neighbor, whom he is living next door to in Richie Rich, fancy Long Island of the time, to the Great Gatsby's parties, of which he throws a lot of them. And Gatsby throws these parties, hoping that when the rich and affluent show up, Daisy will be one of them and he can rekindle his love for her. Because there was a time where the Great Gatsby did, in fact, love Daisy. And he said, well, I'm a nobody doing nothing right now. So wait for me to come back from the war and I will be a hero and I will have made my fortune and we can get married and it'll be fantastic. And like a good woman, she doesn't do that and marry somebody else instead. So Gatsby is like, well, what do you know? So he throws these parties hoping to catch up with her again. Maybe she'll change her mind, because a woman is fond of changing her mind after all. In any case, this goes on and Tom's cheating on Daisy and there's this giant ass party. And in fact, they do all reconnect. What proceeds to happen next is a lot of nothing. And then eventually they all go to the hotel, which is where I like to have all of my fights. I don't know about you, Sean, but if I'm ever going to confront somebody, I like to travel an hour and go to a fancy hotel. Let's just do it there where everyone can see it. Hopefully Tupac and, you know, and Biggie will show up and there'll be a shooting of some kind. It'll be fantastic.
I always like to think that you and I were cut from a little more of the concession stand brawl or boiler room brawl.
Oh, Sean, how would I love to do a Tupelo, Mississippi brawl with you, concession stand brawl with you. But, you know, I like to think I elevate myself to possibly waiting for Suge Knight and Tupac to show up and just get riddled with bullets. Anyway,
I'd settle for the Lion's Den.
Fair enough. Moving on.
It was good enough for Owen Hart and Ken Shamrock.
Oh, geez,
it's fucking good enough for us.
Wrestling in Stu Hart's basement. Sure. anyway, they go to the hotel and Tom's like, hey, Gatsby, you're full of shit. You're actually a front for the mob. And Gatsby's like, well, never mind all that. Daisy's in love with me. And Daisy was just like, ugh. Sure, I'm in love with you, and sure, I'd rather be with you than my terrible, abusive, cheating husband, but I love him too, and to be a woman. So they all get in different cars, and it's Mario Kart all the way home, and they cross the Rainbow Bridge, and the woman who's been cheating with Tom, she walks into the street away from her abusive husband, and fucking Gatsby just runs her right over. Mm-hmm. Like you do. Anyway, this leads to Tom kind of manipulating things to get the now widowed husband to show up to Gatsby's mansion and shoot him dead in the face, which he does. And then no one goes to Gatsby's funeral. It's all very sad. It's like, you know, a Christmas Carol. No one shows up to Scrooge's funeral. And Daisy and Tom leave the city. And then Tobey Maguire, we flash back to Tobey Maguire. He's in the asylum and he has finished The Great Gatsby and he will go on to board some high school students. Okay. So here's my problem with this wonderful movie, which I showed to my kids because, and this is the heart of my prosecuting argument. When we talk about the visual medium of film, when we talk about directors and, you know, directors of photography who know how to swing a camera, we talk about the ability to create wonderful visuals on screen, but we tend to look at only like the sci-fi fantasy realm. You know, we look at comic book movies, you know, like the spectacle of the Marvel movies, for example. These are wonderful visuals. They take you in, they're believable, and they transport you to another world, such as the joy of movies. But what I wanted to point out to my kids was, this is sound like I'm defending the movie, but I'm not, is that Baz Luhrmann took a very real place in a very real time with presumably real people, not these people in particular, but people of that time who lived the way these people lived. This is what F. Scott Fitzgerald was criticizing in The Great Gatsby, was these people, like a Wes Anderson movie. He is criticizing rich white people. So these people existed, if not by name, then definitely by character. And I wanted to show and I wanted to point out how Baz Luhrmann, especially in the, you know, the big highlight of this thing, the jewel of this piece, the big party scene that that Gatsby throws, what you can do on screen. It's the opposite of George Lucas, who shoved as much garbage into the frame as possible and it looked a mess. This is, you create the most visually stunning, busiest, brightest, most wonderful image on screen, and it is a breath to behold. What a ringmaster Baz Luhrmann and whoever his director of photography was to create that scene. It's awesome. The problem is, that's all that's awesome about this movie. My issue with The Great Gatsby is, and I'll be the first person to say the books are for burning, and the play is the thing. We are here to criticize film. We are not here to criticize the art of adaptation. That is a whole other conversation and a whole other podcast. So I don't care as such that the movie, Baz Luhrmann's take on The Great Gatsby, is sort of a shallow interpretation of the piece and a gross misunderstanding of what the criticism was. I care less about that, and that's not my issue. However, there's a tendency to celebrate excesses in film. Excesses of a period of time, excesses of an event, excesses of a class of people. And that I don't think is good. And that's what happens here in this interpretation of The Great Gatsby, is it's very much focused on the love story, the love triangle between Gatsby, Tom, and Daisy. And there's almost no criticism of this era. There's no criticism of the lifestyle of these people and their excesses. It is a soap opera, writ large, told wonderfully and visually. That's my problem with The Great Gatsby, is that it's a kind of an empty, shallow, and pedantic film that tricks you with jingling keys into thinking it's awesome. Now, it's held up by phenomenal performances by this cast. Leonardo DiCaprio is amazing. I mean, Tobey Maguire kind of reminds me of me in our production, our high school production of The Crucible, where I forgot to react to the girls running around the courtroom. And so I'm just sort of staring off into deep space. And, there's my drama instructor and our director going, "Radulich, react." And I'm like, "What? Huh?" You would have thought I was stoned, but I wouldn't do pot until much later in life. So anyway, so Tobey Maguire, as I said before, even my son picked this up, and he's 10, or just about to be 10. He's just fucking looking around like, I exist. This is something my son would say. I'm here, and I exist. Good for you. Are you going to be a part of this drama? Not really. I'm just going to stand in the room and jerk myself off. All right? Kind of a waste of Tobey Maguire, if you ask me. You know, when it focuses on Daisy, Tom, and Gatsby, I think there's enough grist for the mill in terms of drama, but everybody else just gets kind of lost. And, you know, Tobey Maguire is just kind of a passenger in his own film, and not a very interesting one to that extent. It is overly reliant on not just the visual aspects, but also the costume and the set design, of which, when you look at the awards for this thing, and I think this is like the biggest piece of evidence I can give you that this movie is a lot of sizzle and almost no steak, is it wins for things in any award that matters, like the Oscars, for visual stuff. And as a matter of fact, I can tell you, it won for best costume design and best production design. You know what it didn't win for? Best picture. It wasn't even nominated. It's not. Furthermore, and to conclude my prosecuting argument, the film, because it does not adequately or appropriately criticize the time that it takes place, or the people living in that time and how they affected the world around them, and it focuses entirely too much on the interpersonal human drama, kind of makes this an exercise in masturbation. It's not a waste for kind of film people to kind of watch and go, look what you can do with the camera and some film, you know, and some well-told direction. It is kind of a waste if you're looking for a film that says anything important about anything. And that's kind of the frustrating thing about it. And I think if I was having we're doing the old Lincoln Douglas debate here, where I talk, then you talk, and then, you know, we'll commit later. But I think if I was at a casual conversation with people right now, they would be like, oh, but I love this movie. It's so good. It's got such great actors, such great costumes. I'm like, okay, but what does it say about the nature of man and how we treat each other? Nothing that the Real Housewives of Georgia hasn't said. Like, people cheat. People are shitty. You know, women tell you they love you and it turns out they don't. All right. Like, I knew that already. And you're not saying anything profound with this movie. And I think it also speaks to Baz Luhrmann's sort of intellect, where I think from a visual standpoint, he's a genius. But as we all know, there's a lot of different kind of smart out there. And I think he's another one that is taken with a time period, taken with an aesthetic and in love with it. And he wants to show you how much he loves it on screen. But then you go, but why, Baz? Why do you think the people acted this way and the time was that way? Why were these things happening? And he goes, the party was fun? Like, oh boy. I compared this to Babylon, where I think Babylon had a better take on the excesses of Hollywood and the people in it than this one does on around that same time period and the people in it, just in a different place. You know, Babylon takes place in Los Angeles. This place takes in New York. I'm going to cede the floor to the defense, but if we're like, what's the big picture here? What's the headline? What are you trying to tell us? I'm trying to tell you that this film is guilty of being a visually stunning piece of candy, but is in no way fulfilling on any deep level in terms of theme, in terms of theme. Your witness.
All right, so I have to hand it to Mark, because Mark actually made some substantial, very valid points about the shortcoming of the movie. No, it doesn't exactly say anything that's particularly world-bending. Yes, it is more sizzle than steak. I will admit that right the fuck up on Front Street. But while I'm normally also right on board with setting source material aside when it comes to looking at the movies and shows that we do, this is one time when I think an exception is warranted, where you kind of have to contrast the two in order to appreciate what a genuinely good movie this really is. So I'm going to have to go back and start with Nick, because there's a lot to unpack here, and talking about Nick kind of bleeds over into something interesting that I discovered that I think might even enhance a few other viewings of the film, quite frankly. The first thing you have to remember about this whole thing, about the story, is who wrote it. And you have to remember that in addition to being, you know, an affluent white man in the 20s, Foxcotch was also a bigot. He was a bigot and he was a misogynist. This is plain as day throughout the original book. There's pretty much no bones made about it. If anything, I would go so far as to say that's one of the things that you could almost say this take on it kind of whitewashes, because we see glimpses of the bigotry, of the racism, of the misogyny, but it's never quite as saying the loud part even louder as the novel gets sometimes. It's shown more as juxtaposing Nick and Gatsby and their crowd kind of slumming it and kind of subtly highlighting just how out of place they look and feel and very, very clearly are. Not necessarily always having the grandest of impacts on that, you know, less affluent environment, except for, you know, how carelessly they'll destroy anything in it just based on their own whims, their own wants, whatever. But it also comes in the fact that in the novel, one of the things about Nick that makes him particularly unlikable, and again, if you've never read it, I cannot stress this enough, there is not a patently likable character in this book. Nick is about as close as you will get, but the fact is, Nick spends an uncomfortable, obnoxious portion of especially the early acts telling you just how honest he is. Boy, that's always a green flag when you're meeting someone new, isn't it? When they just can't shut up about how nice and how honest they are.
That's what I put on my Facebook dating profile. I'm amazing. You're a crazy person if you don't date me. I'm the safest person you'll ever meet.
I'm such a nice guy. Why will no one fuck me?
So many
matches. But the thing is, and here is where the movie diverts a little bit, is one of the devices that's used in the book, and now after a second reading, I can absolutely verify this, is that you have to keep in mind that in the 1920s, queerness of any stripe was seen as a moral and psychological failing.
Just as a brief aside, for a while it was actually documented in the diagnostic, whatever DSM stands for. It was in the book of psychological disorders was homosexuality. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Up until I think the 70s or the 80s, somewhere in there.
Exactly. And there is a scene in the book that kind of, I get the sense it's kind of an ingenious means of sort of allowing the reader to put one and one together to get gay as fuck. And kind of drive home Nick's dishonesty, his moral failing, despite how much the lady doth protest. And that is the Mr. McKee scene. The scene where the kind of graceful, effeminately described, I wouldn't say flamboyantly, but to say elegantly described photographer Mr. McKee is kind of bouncing around this this party in the slums of New York with the rest of the crew. And at one point, Nick reaches up to wipe a very stray little bit of a lather off of his face. And by any measure, a very intimate gesture. And that might have been enough if just left on its own. But then we also get Nick getting blackout drunk, waking up half naked in Mr. McKee's room while Mr. McKee is in his underwear on the bed reading the newspaper. And then it just jumps forward where apparently we have agreed to never speak of the shortcut again. And Nick is just at the train station, just fully clothed, trying not to think of this, and just dying to immerse himself in the paper. And this is a part of an improvised, but also very valid and interesting queer reading of The Great Gatsby. And you've heard me say it on the show 100,000 times, and I'll say it one more time for the people in the back. Dave Grohl has a favorite saying about music, because of course, Dave is a musician. Says, and I paraphrase a little bit, rock and roll is amazing because you can sing one song out to 85,000 people and they will sing it right back at you for 85,000 different reasons. And yes, it's death of the author time because Fuck Scotch put something out into the world that he absolutely, I can 100% money back guarantee you, did not mean to have a queer reading. But in those events, the queer coding was still perceived, and it still turned into another interpretation on the story. And it also bears noting that this is a scene that no matter how many times up to now The Great Gatsby has been adapted, and how notably challenging it is to get Fuck Scotch's estate to license people to adapt it, conspicuously, that scene is left out of every single retelling of the story. And yes, you know, fit me for a tinfoil hat. I think you're a fool if you believe that's coincidence. It's because it is something that his estate probably doesn't want being misread in any positive way. If they felt, that's assuming that they kind of follow along with their illustrious ancestors' thinking. Or they may just see that as being too pedantic. Because you know, us fags only came along about 60 years ago. You know, we're a new thing.
Sure. Very new to the human condition and species.
Right, like MMA. Yeah. But you know, not like we've been provably been around for centuries or anything like that. No, roommates. Good friends, traveling companions. But it's interesting because you can transpose that reading of it being all about Nick's unrequited passion for Gatsby, and yet Gatsby's meanwhile longing for Daisy, as in fact being one of the earliest mainstream queer romances to be kind of disseminated by mass media. And the amazing thing is, I actually tried it. If you rewatch the movie through that lens, it doesn't really meaningfully change any of the other aspects of the story, except that I arguably think that watching that all unfold is far more compelling than the indulgent, pretentious, yet mercifully short story that we got about Nick just standing idly by while this mysterious playboy is carrying a torch for his lost love until he drops the torch on himself. I think that makes it far more interesting. I think it makes Nick far more interesting. It lends so much more to Tobey Maguire's performance if you watch it that way, and even kind of adds another layer to the oblivity of Gatsby. You watch the scenes with Nick and Tom and how Tom is he's mesmerizingly rugged. Joel Edgerton is absolutely masterful. I love that he feels right at home in this 20s setting without having to resort to the real slang heavy rapid fire dialogue presentation that you would see in parodies of life.
Oh my God. Take a drink every time they say old sport, you will die.
Yeah. It would have been so easy for him to fall into that scenery gobbling self-parody. But no, he's just kind of feels like this very authentic century-old time bomb.
Yeah.
That is always kind of one stray look from a colored man from absolutely going off all over NYC. At the time, you know, you can see that obviously there's something about him that kind of captivates Nick a little bit in very much an ooh daddy kind of sense. But
One real quick interruption. This is another movie, the second Baz Luhrmann movie in a row where I identified with the villain yet again. I went through this with Moulin Rouge where, you know, it's just like, you know, I'm supposed to marry the rich, powerful guy, but I'm in love with the poor writer. And, you know, and the fucking rich, powerful guy's like, what the fuck is wrong with me? Like, why are you running away from me? What has he got that I ain't got?
Yeah, but that's the thing.
And then here I am, I'm Tom, you know, and in comes this charlatan, Jay Gatsby, and they're saying his money. And he's like, Daisy, I'm here. And it's just like, I've given you everything, lady. I have to stop identifying with Baz Luhrmann's villains. This is a problem. All right, sorry.
But that's the thing about it, though, is the fact that you never really identify with Tom. You dislike him immediately, but he's never exactly mustache twirly.
No. No, and I don't want to interrupt you, but you can absolutely see where Tom is coming from.
Oh, sure. Sure. It's you can't not see where Tom is where Tom is coming from. But meanwhile, even though on a certain, you know, kind of carnal level, he's very taken with Tom, you can tell that it's Gatsby that's really captured his heart and his mind.
Yeah.
And it makes Nick feel like so much less of a fly on the wall, and it makes it feel like so much less of being entirely Leonardo DiCaprio's movie, and a little bit more of it being kind of an unintended shared tragic moment between those two on a whole other level. But that's the thing, is you kind of, and that's kind of the beauty of the movie, is the fact that between having that reading and Baz Luhrmann's visual style kind of putting right out there what the novel never really says loudly enough, and that's the fact that this whole dreamy aesthetic, this fantasy world, it's all meant to be projected through the prism of Gatsby's mind, through his eyes, his delusions, his fixations on the past. And the 20s, if I remember my English class correctly, was a time when a lot of literature was very fixated on kind of the romance and solipsism of memory. Gatsby truly is off in his own world. And I just kind of realized the worst things that you kind of see in the movie, you never really see in Gatsby's presence unless... kind of until we get to the hotel bar throwdown between him and Tom, where Tom calls him on the carpet. Everything bad is always kind of happening when he's on around. It's kind of like how wrestling reference time. If you ever watched Raw or SmackDown when Kane was on their rosters, somehow, for some inexplicable reason, Kane always had a lighting director with that red gel right behind him, wherever Kane happened to be and whatever he happened to be doing. It's kind of or kind of like how on AEW, how timeless Tony Storm is always shot in black and white. When Gatsby's around, everything is all elegance and glitz and decadence and excess. Even the trash after the party is, you know, fancy clothing and champagne bottles and such, and the moon is still dappling down off it, because he really is just off in his own realm of kind of fantasy and optimism. It's something that the novel means to be subtle with admirably. I admire their restraint, but it never gets across quite as plainly and as easily to absorb as the movie does. And that's where kind of like how Muhammad Ali was the role that Will Smith was meant to play. This kind of feels like maybe the story that Baz Luhrmann was meant to tell, because he was actually able, to my enduring surprise, one up F. Scott Fitzgerald. I'll use his proper name just this once more, and kind of what's the word I'm looking for, elevate his own story, his own masterpiece. This is one time when I think his habit of throwing in the anachronistic needle drops gets a little bit grating. Maybe it's partially because the song choices weren't quite as catchy or as interesting. It was just like some reason the hip hop needle drop just didn't work quite as well as they did the more bombastic ones in Moulin Rouge in particular, I think. I am not going to throw shade on the Rhapsody in Blue scene, though. Absolutely not. But masterful, deserves to be one of those memorable frames of cinema that gets, I'm sorry, cinema. That gets talked because really you just can't find a flaw in that shot, in that moment, in the way it executes, the line reading, the reveal, all of it. It's just, it's so admirably perfect. I mean, it might be the best shot of Baz Luhrmann's entire career. And that's not throwing shade at him. If you remember the other episode, I actually quite respect him. But it's one of those where I feel like it's one where he knew, that's it. I may never have everything come together like this, quite so perfectly. And he really does kind of rein in the absurd bombast throughout the entire movie, though. He's able to convey the decadence, the elegance, the prestige, but it never has that feeling in Moulin Rouge quite like it feels like the movie is screaming in your face. It's ideally paced. It's about 2.5 hours. Feels like about 1:45. Really, really moves nicely. I don't think there's a bad performance to be found in this entire thing. Leonardo DiCaprio displays some subtlety and some immersion in the characters that thankfully never goes to that length of method acting that some will maybe wander just a little far into, like Will Smith, Daniel Day-Lewis, Jim Carrey.
He's just shy of Jeffrey Wright and Robert Pattinson in The Batman when they've got the penguin cornered. Like, it's not that bad, but it gets close.
Yeah. There aren't that many big emotional moments with him, but there don't really need to be. He doesn't really need to have like a Gary Oldman type moment or a John Malkovich moment that calls on a kind of screaming transformative intensity.
Yeah, he never quite gets the Tommy Wiseau, "You're tearing me apart."
Exactly. What I really liked about it, and it was such a nice, ingenious moment, and goddamn, toot the horn for Leo on this one. There's a thing in the book where Gatsby will let his posh accent slip a little bit,
right,
when he's sometimes in the throes of big emotions. And DiCaprio pulls that off, but he manages to do it kind of so well that if you're not listening for it, you might miss it. But if you are listening for it, it'll be kind of right there where you expect it. It's particularly noticeable, I think, in the first ride in the yellow car that he takes with Nick.
Can I just tell you? We've all been Nick in that car ride where you number of times. You can't, there's nowhere for you to go. You have to listen. The person next to you won't shut up. And he's just telling you the most boring story. But you know, for some odd reason, you can't get away. You can't stop him. And it's just like, this is just a verbal assault. That's the beauty of that car ride is, You're hearing Gatsby, but you're looking at Nick, and Nick wants to, and Nick is like, I have no idea whether to believe you or not, and I desperately want out of this car, and there's nowhere for him to go. And it's great. It's one of the few moments that Baz Luhrmann captures here where he is in his own way criticizing Gatsby, but in the subtlest way, to where if you're not paying attention, you're going to miss it. You're just assuming Nick, you know, because you have to watch Tobey Maguire in that scene.
I think it's deeply fascinating that Gatsby Gatsby is a criminal, of course. He's a bootlegger. But he's never really presented as being especially suspicious, except for the fact that you don't know where his money came from. And that's it. There's really nothing about his behavior in and of itself, or about his presentation.
Well, that's the thing. This is all like an elaborate, elongated ruse to win the attention of Daisy back.
Yeah.
So he has no reason to not be on his best behavior. In fact, if he does misbehave, he's gonna miss his shot.
Yeah. And even then, he's a bootlegger. even that is presented as him being very much kind of a community pillar. He's kind of the worst kind of wealthy, and that's the indifferent kind.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the patently destructive, but just the bull in the socioeconomic China shop ignorant.
The wealth is a means to an end, and the end is Daisy.
Way too much money to be that poorly informed. Really is all for one person.
But that goes back,
almost had her.
But that goes back to my criticism, is the book isn't that myopic, and the movie is. The movie is dead centered on his pursuit of Daisy to the exclusion of all else, and the book is not necessarily that way.
No, but I also can't deny that the tighter story does work. And it works whether you want to stick with the traditional the cishet reading of it, where it's just all about Gatsby and Daisy, and Nick is just over here on the sideline trying to be the best wingman he can be.
Yeah.
For this charismatic tidal wave that's sweeping across the Big Apple. Or if you read it in the queer sense of he's captivated by this worldly phenomenon, but all the while Gatsby's never gonna have eyes for him. And either one, I can't believe it, because I mean, yes, for the longest time, you know, we gays have had to kind of make do with kind of what alternate readings of something that we could, because we damn sure weren't getting it outright from the people who were holding the cameras and the pens and the checkbook and whatnot. But this is one time when there's really nothing hurt by it. If anything, it's the best way to watch it. And I think that ultimately what this boils down to, and I'll just kind of leave it at this, is the fact that the movie takes the original story in a fresh direction. So it's a tentative to just how much potential there was in that novel.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I think this was the one that should have won Leo the Academy Award.
Mm.
He should have gotten it. I think there may be an argument that he should have gotten it. Who won Best Actor that year?
Hang on. The 2013.
And as a third point, I'll say it cements that Baz Luhrmann has a style that may not necessarily work for everything. It may be situational, but in those situations, God damn, it worked.
The 2013.
Yes. Best Actor 2013.
No, it would be 20. Hang on. It'd be 2014. Give me a second. This is 80. Okay. Yeah. 86. I'm in the wrong year. Here we go. Best Actor. So he wasn't nominated for this in 20. What year is this? 2014. He wasn't
even nominated?
Not for Best Actor, but he was nominated for Best Actor for The Wolf of Wall Street. So the best actor
there, I guess.
Yeah, he's not nominated for best supporting actor either. So for best actor was Matthew McConaughey in Dallas Buyers Club. The other ones were Christian Bale in American Hustle, Bruce Dern for Nebraska, Leonardo DiCaprio for The Wolf of Wall Street, and Chiwetel Ejiofor for 12 Years a Slave.
I forgot that Wolf of Wall Street came out that year.
Yeah.
So.
All right.
Okay. So I had one last weird bonus question for you, though.
Yes.
Okay. I was thinking about this the other day, and I want you to settle something for me, or at least try to.
Sure.
Daisy's little speech about how she wants to have a girl and wants her to grow up to be a pretty little fool. There were two readings of this that I can think of that I've heard. I'd like to know which one you think is more valid. One, if I recall correctly, was from my AP English class, where we were told that the prevailing interpretation was that she wants her to be a fool so that she can have just a nice, quiet, easy life and not have to work, and everything just being dependent on just spitting out them pale babies. Whereas the other, I think, was a little more thoughtful. And it was one that I encountered in, I know it was either the Lost in Adaptation episode or the Sin Squad video, but it was saying that she wants her to be a fool because that's the only way anybody could be happy in this world as it exists, is if they're a fool, is if they're just completely empty-headed and oblivious to everything going on around them.
When I was in college, I was a language and literature major, not an English major per se, but again, took as many writing classes as I did literature classes. And there was a couple of Bible as literature classes. And the reason why is, as I've told my kids, that the Bible is an instruction manual on behavior. These are more or less, to one degree or another, agreed upon ways of behaving so that you will have a fulfilled and successful life. If you do these things, generally speaking, you know, bad luck aside, you will succeed, and you will find satisfaction.
And hear that, gamers? Before IGN, there was the apostles.
So what is the, you know, so when you think about like the tree of knowledge and the apple and all of that, it's a metaphor for when you don't know, there is a, you know, kind of like the Nine Inch Nails song, there's a happiness in slavery, there's a happiness in ignorance. When you don't know, when you have no idea what's going on, when you're, you know, when your bubble isn't pierced, when the veil is on, there's an ignorance taking place that shields you from all the bad things, and it provides you a space to be happy, to be filled, to be sustained, to not know what else could be possibly out there, and to be satisfied with what you have. There's an argument of whether that's good or bad. I don't want to have it now, but that's what that's saying. To the point about Daisy, it's why I brought this up. The tree of knowledge parable is, you know, again, a way of saying when you take a bite of that apple, when you get that knowledge, suddenly you can see behind the code of the Matrix. If you want a more modern parable, you know, the Matrix.
Why, oh, why didn't I take the blue pill?
Well, you know, what the Matrix was basically saying was, and it's one of the reasons why I love this trilogy, at least the themes behind it, is essentially there are people who are perfectly happy to remain ignorant. They're just trying to get through life, and they're trying to get it with as little pain as possible. And they don't need to see behind the code of the Matrix. They don't need to be woken up. They are happy to remain in ignorant bliss. I think Daisy is a tortured individual. Daisy has seen some shit. And, you know, you want better for your children, and sometimes better for your children may be interpreted as don't be exposed to the trauma, to the torture that I have been. I hope life is better for you. I hope you grow up and remain ignorant of life's slings and arrows. So, you know, the word fool, I think, is used in that sense as, you know, somebody who has not been exposed to the world's great evils. There was a kid that I went to college with, and I'll never forget him. He was pretty sheltered. He worked in his parents' business, and when he came to college, he struggled because he was sheltered and not particularly socialized. We watched Clerks together. We saw Clerks at a independent theater in Pittsburgh where I did my first and only semester of college.
God, how cool that must have been.
It was fun. He didn't get it. So I started working when I was 13 years old, and I worked different retail stores or different restaurants, things of that nature. I've been working pretty much my entire life from the time of like 14 on. And he only worked for his parents, and he had never had the retail experience. And what is Clerks but a day in the life of somebody working in, you know, a retail establishment, you know, a convenience store? And I'm laughing my ass off because Kevin Smith is telling a first person perspective of people who have had those experiences and worked in those places. And when the movie was over, I'm like, wow, Clerks was amazing. That was so funny. You know, what a relatable movie. And he goes, I didn't get it. Like, what do you mean you didn't get it? Mm-hmm. Like, I don't understand what was funny about that movie. Like, was that supposed to be real life? Mm-hmm. Utterly, utterly ignorant of that aspect of society. And like, it bummed him out, you know, to finally see a window into this other place that he had no experience with. And he didn't love it. And that's been my experience with a lot of people, not to go too far off on a tangent here, but there are people who are very happy to remain in their bubble. And when you purse that bubble, they become violently angry with you. They are not appreciative of truth saying.
But I think you kind of hit on something that also points to one of the greatest Gatsby's greatest failings, unfortunately. And that this is in terms of both the original novel and the movie. You talked about how everything feels inconsequential, how it doesn't feel like it really has anything to say, how there's nothing significant to take away from it. Well, part of the problem goes back to the fact that this is supposed to be the great American novel. And that's a concept that unfortunately is doomed to fail, because the whole idea of the great American novel is supposed to be that it unifies and it encompasses the totality of the American spirit and the American experience. Here's the problem with that. The great American novels, as they supposedly exist, are all written by people who look like me and Mark.
So I got to cut in because you're making the American fiction argument. I don't know if you've seen American Fiction yet. It was nominated for a Best Picture.
I have not seen it yet. So that is completely unintentional.
I talked about this at length, so I'm not going to get into it now. But essentially, there's an argument between two black authors, and one of them wrote a book about an authentic book about the inner city experience and the quote unquote ghetto culture. And one of them did the same book, but did it over the top as a way of protesting that this should not be the only way people see us as, you know, horrible ghetto monsters. And her retort back to that was, but it is an authentic experience. It's just not your authentic experience. To not represent all the experiences possible is a giant disservice to any one people. That's the argument that they're having, because yeah. Jeffrey Wright's argument essentially is, why do we let ourselves be seen this way, as if this is nothing else to black people? And she was just like, well, go ahead and write those books then. I mean, no one may buy them, but go ahead and write about the experiences of well-to-do black people, or this black people, or that people. But I wanted to write this, and this sells. And I don't know what to tell you. That's the market.
Well, and that's... And again, that's entirely valid. And that's the thing, is it's not...
That goes to your point about the great American novel. It's like, well, what is the authentic American experience?
Well,
The Jay Gatsby experience, or the fucking Killers of the Flower Moon experience?
Well, yes, but that's exactly the thing that I'm trying to get at.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say is, it's not so much that it has nothing to say. It's just that everything that it has to say, we've heard 100,000 times from 100,000 authors who all think they're doing something spectacularly unique, when the problem is they are now and always will be absolute foreigners sealed off from the bedrock experiences that make up so much of American life as we know it, as our parents knew it, as their grandparents knew it. But the problem is yeah, just as American fiction, from what it sounds like laid out, is those are not stories people are interested in hearing because they're just seen as distractions from what they really want to hear, from what they've always heard.
Can you imagine you've poured your life's blood, just all of your creative, we're going to move forward after I say this, but yeah. You've poured your life's blood, all of your creative juices, just everything you've poured into this one project, and this one project is criticizing upper class white people. And you're just like, I've done it. I've said the thing. I've made the criticism. I have parodied and satired people. I have brought low the upscale white experience. And he turns to his left, and there's 700 other people who have done the same thing in multiple formats. And it's like, you know, that's the thing that I think you're sort of pointing at. And what makes me laugh is because I've said this on the Metal Hammer of Doom about a lot of bands. Like tomorrow night, we're doing the Metal Hammer of Doom jukebox on the new Ministry album. And I love Ministry to death. I'm actually going to see them in 2 weeks. They were a part of my big metal awakening back when I was a teenager. But I've always laughed at kind of Al Jorgensen and his sort of hoity attitude towards conservatives and Republicans, you know, Christians, you know, and that he's, again, him, Fat Mike from NoFX. You know, they all have this like really condescending attitude towards anyone right of them. And it's like, we've done the thing. We've put we've put out the album. We've said the thing. We've done the tour. Surely the people will come with us now. And they don't. It's like, that's what I'm getting at. It's like, I love to talk about this stuff. And I'll read the books. I'll watch the movies. I'll listen to the albums. But I've said this to Jesse in the past, and it bears repeating. If these people think this is going to like inspire revolution, yo, this ain't Vietnam. People's lives are not at stake as such, as directly as it was. I mean, I think what people forget about, and I've said this before, what people forget about the culture that came out of the Nam experience was the very palpable fear you may be sent to die. And that's not currently hanging over anyone's head. You know, no. Don Rumsfeld said, we're not doing a draft army. And in the 20-aught years since he said it, it hasn't happened. And we've been in multiple wars. Like,
no.
Yeah, this generation has nothing to fear. And at this point, the way we're going, you know, if we're drafted, you're drafted to sit behind a console and run a drone. You know,
yeah.
You're not being sent into combat. So, again, what drove the protestations of the Vietnam era, half of it was civil rights and the very like basic civil rights of we would like to vote. You know, we don't want to live in separate but equal. We would like to have, you know, hoses not turned on us and, you know, be bitten by dogs and thrown out of schools and shit. And then there's we don't want to die in Nam. Neither one of those things exists right now. So you have various artists that are very much, you know, have a thing to say about a culture, about a class. And it's nice. I don't want them to not say it. I will absolutely appreciate the fact that they are saying it and they should say it, but it's not going to, but they wanted to spark a revolution. They wanted to spark a movement. They wanted to spark people doing stuff about it. And the last time anyone did anything like that, it was Trump. And it was very much speaking to, hey, have you felt displaced lately? Have you as a white male feel like you just don't have any control over your life and the world around you? Well, if you vote for me, I'll build a wall and I'll make Mexicans pay for it. And you'll get your job back that wasn't taken over by Mexicans, but rather by technology. You know, it's just a whole thing. And I don't want to get into it. I've talked about it a million times with Jesse and a whole host of other people. My point is, like, the last time we even got close to any kind of a movement was the stupid January 6th thing where he convinced people that he didn't fairly lose an election. He did. But, and then look what happened. They all, you know, like after very patient fucking law enforcement, it's like, yes, guy with moose head. Yes, angry MAGA conservative. Let's fucking move him on out of here. Don't kill him. And then slowly but surely, all brought up on charges. Like, this worked itself out over time. But that's the closest we've gotten. So I would just like, so to the F. Scott Fitzgerald of then and now, you've got a hard time reaching that audience that you're trying to reach to get them to get them to motivate them to do something. Back to the film, so we can wrap this up. So I made my argument over what's wrong with the film. Your counter essentially was there's more here than meets the eye, which is fine. And so the only thing I want to say in conclusion, in reality, is that I love the movie. I don't care, as I personally don't care, that it's not a critique of the excesses of the 20s. I appreciate the drama. It's one of the things that Robert and I kind of get in a fist fight over on Robert Winfrey and I from Damn You Hollywood get in a fist fight over on a lot of our podcasts is essentially that I don't necessarily always care if it's not deep and profound. His remark to me in our last podcast, I think it was, he was like, it was the Oscar podcast. He was like, you are so much more interested in the lives of teenage girls than I could ever be. And yeah, that's not wrong. There's a certain degree of empathy I feel for a lot of different, you know, groups of people. And and if that's all I'm getting on film is, you know, the human drama between three teenage girls and poor Dakota Johnson, you poor thing. I'll pull that out of Madam Web and I'll be okay with it. I'll be interested in at least that element of it. You know, the reason why Poor Things and Barbie moved me the way that it did was because I was very much in tune with the complaints and interests and the thoughts of women. And if you're not, then yeah, those movies are gonna you're not gonna be interested in at all. So the great draw for The Great Gatsby for me is that single-minded pursuit of Jay towards Daisy. And that frustration Tom has, the very palpable and very relatable frustration Tom has of, I have done everything. I am authentic. I have given you the world. How could you?
I am such a nice guy.
How could you turn? I'm sorry. I still relate. How could you turn to this bullshit emotional support animal charlatan and think and even had consider him as a romantic partner? And it's like, yeah, Tom, I hear you loud and clear, buddy. I hear you loud and clear. I'm very much drawn in by that human drama to the point that I don't care. He's not commenting on the 20s itself. And then you get to the meat of the matter, that the big party scene, the visuals, and it's like, I'm going to forgive this movie for a lot of its thematic sins because the visuals are some of the best I've ever seen captured on film. And film, as I said, put it on a t-shirt, Mindy. Film is a visual medium. If the visuals are working, you can forgive a lot of faults of the movie. I'm going to give you the 50 words or less last word here, and then we're going to get out. Sean, that's to you. Or did you freeze? No, he might have froze. All righty. Well, we had a little bit of an audience there at the end, which I was happy about. I was glad people tuned in, at least for a little bit of our discussion there, especially as we went a little tangential. Hopefully Sean comes back, but if this is anything like what happened on our aborted show Tuesday, he's going to have to pop out and pop back in again. So in the meantime, I'm going to go ahead and draw us to a close. This has been our On Trial of Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire. I rather enjoyed this discussion. I really enjoyed this movie. I definitely enjoyed the viewing experience of sharing it with my kids. I'm always curious to see how they're going to react to something, especially when so much of what I show them is science fiction and fantasy. And then I show them something like this, and I was like, gosh, I hope I can maintain their attention span. And then my son says, my God, this is amazing. This is like the best 3-hour movie you've ever shown me. Movie train your kids, people. Show them the classics. All right, well, we're waiting for Sean to come back. I mentioned it before. Tomorrow night, we are obviously not going to be live. We never are when it comes to the Metal Hammer of Doom Jukebox, because we play videos and YouTube nerfs you if you're playing a video live. But we will be uploading, after we've recorded it, our Metal Hammer of Doom Jukebox Ministry, Hopium for the Masses. We are going to be reviewing Ministry's previous catalog of albums, play some music videos, have a discussion. I'm sure Jesse will continue to convince us that AI should write music. That boy has written an entire album of AI written music. It's fantastic. I should say prompted. He didn't write shit. He prompted an entire album's worth of AI written songs. So good for Jesse. Tuesday. Now, normally Damn You Hollywood is on Mondays, but it's going to be on Tuesday this week to accommodate Zach Strobel. Good to his mother. He's a very good boy. He wanted to do Kung Fu Panda. Alexis Haina wanted to do Kung Fu Panda. So I relented, even though it wasn't on my schedule. I took my kids to go see it today. As a matter of fact, it was better than I expected it to be. So myself, Alexis, Zach, and Robert Winfrey will be reviewing Kung Fu Panda 4 on Tuesday. Thursday was supposed to be a triple feature, but two of the movies we can't find. So instead, myself and Pat Mullen, continuing to have fun, we'll be right back here in the courtroom on Trial, and we're going to be looking at Josie and the Pussycats. Yes, sir. The Rachel Lee Cook movie. Tara Reid, I believe, is in it. Just the funniest shit movie. All kinds of goofy, and we're going to have a great time talking about it. We talked about Dune, part two, and Jonas, my son, he was on Avatar, The Last Airbender, which was hosted by Alexis. He did a really good job with that, so did she, quite frankly. So go ahead and check those out. All right, I don't know if Sean's coming back or not, but I am at Mark Rattledge on TikTok, as you can see here in the box. So check out clips of our shows or karaoke, clothed or otherwise. Conversations between my son and my father, good old grandpa, where they're screaming at each other, and it's the most popular thing I've ever posted on TikTok. So check that out. I'm also at Mark Rattledge on Instagram, if you want to follow me there. So this has been On Trial. Court is now in recess. For Sean Comer, you're not, wherever he may have gone, possibly back to his home planet. Be well, be safe, and behave.